Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Aligne lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I am your host, Nick Toro Jr. For today's episode, I'm going to have a discussion with someone who is deeply entrenched in the world of independent photo book publishing. His name is Jesse Lenz, and aside from being a photographer himself and a family man raising a large family in Ohio, Jesse is also responsible for the Charcoal Press and the Charcoal Book Club, both which focus on photography books, independently published photography books. Jesse is also responsible for the Chico Hot Springs Photo Review, and we first crossed paths at Polycopies, which is an independent photo publishing show in Paris that coincides with Paris Photo. And I was really excited to meet the man behind the Charcoal Press. And I found out pretty quickly that Jesse is the man behind the Charcoal Press. I'm sure he gathers up help when he needs it, but he really is the driving force behind the press, the book club, the photo review, and also raising a family and creating an amazing body of photographic work in his own right. So Jesse and I talk all about the trials and tribulations of the photo book publishing world. And we do talk about his upcoming book release, which I saw some of the photos from. And Jesse really has an amazing, unique perspective on his personal life. And that's what that book is all about. And we talk about that as well. So really excited to share this episode with you all today. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Jesse Lenz. Thanks for joining me today. All right. Well, welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Jesse Lenz.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I want to circle back because we were talking offline, but there's probably at least some entertainment there. So your last name is Lenz, which it just lends itself to a photographic pursuit. So I guess it seems like you were destined to work in photography.
Well, it's funny because, like I was saying, I didn't go to school for photography. Photography for me was always something that I loved, but I loved it because I loved the things I was photographing more than photography. So it was always just kind of something I did for like a greater purpose. So I never really had the connection made to my name in a humorous way or anything like that, really, until like I was doing my first book like 4 years ago, and someone was like, man, you really have a good name for this. And you know, because it's not spelled the same way, it's L-E-N-Z, it's like I just don't really ever think of it. I remember just thinking like, oh yeah, like I guarantee if I went to like photo school, I would have had lots of jokes heard over the years about this, but it's kind of the first time I'm hearing about it now. Okay. But yeah, it's a good name to have.
So Jesse, just to start off and introduce you to the audience, just give me a little bit sort of background of like who you are, what you've been doing, why we're having this conversation, but just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do photographically.
I feel like we could take that down quite a few different rabbit holes. I always tell people like being an artist means you do like 10 things and get paid for one, maybe. I'm a dad. I have 6 kids. I have a farm here in Ohio. So I do that. I also, you know, outside my own work, and I know we'll talk about my own work later, so I'll kind of leave that off just to kind of give some of the other background. But I run Charcoal Book Club, which is I started it and run it. It's a book of the month club for photography monographs. So I always say it's like a wine of the month club, but for, you know, signed photo books. And been doing that for, I think, like seven or eight years. It kind of all blends together. Then run the Chico Review, a big photography portfolio review in Montana every year. And yeah, I also publish books under Charcoal Press, which is our imprint. I'm sure we'll get into this more, but I feel like everything in my career has been just kind of like one step after another. Before that, I used to publish an art and travel quarterly, and we would go on location to places throughout the North America and create a 200 page book about the place over like living there for like 3 or 4 months. So that's when I kind of started publishing and did that for years before I ever discovered photo books. And I realized like, oh, this is actually the thing I always wanted to do. And, you know, before that, used to tour in bands and, you know, all sorts of fun stuff.
So yeah. When we met in Paris and I was monopolizing your time at Polycopies while you were working hard, trying to move your books. We did talk a little bit about the sort of the touring band, sort of in your previous life. And I actually do want to touch on that a little bit, maybe not right this second, but I think that, you know, everything that you just described, and knowing what I know about Charcoal and, you know, its different, manifestations, and then also your work personally, obviously there's like a DIY, motivation or just sort of, MO behind a lot of what you're doing. And so, and then it seems to me, and I know when we talked about it, like, you know, sort of a, you know, packing a band in a van and you know, booking gigs and traveling from city to city. I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of that skill set that you develop in that world probably does translate into the world of, whether it's photography specifically or just like self-publishing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's definitely, you know, like a common ground there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's exactly the same thing. Like, I think to me, there are two worlds existing parallel to each other. I remember in high school, when MySpace came out, it was the first time you could really book shows yourself in different places. Cause all of a sudden you could find venues in different places. I remember being in high school and booking, you know, nationwide like tours with the band that I was in. And so it, you know, and I always grew up in like just kind of piece of shit places. Every state or country I lived in, it was always kind of the worst version of that. Like, you know, I was born in Montana originally, then I moved to the Soviet Union, and I did most of my growing up though in West Virginia, but it was like coal country area. So like Wheeling, just like not even pretty West Virginia. And pretty much anything you wanted to do that was like cool or, you know, skateboarding or music or art, you had to do it yourself because there was no infrastructure. And there's also no money for it or in it. And I think that like, there's a really interesting thing that happens when you kind of do things for the love of the game. So like when we were building skate parks, you know, we were actually building them ourselves. We were building the ramps for us to use. When I started, you know, booking shows, I actually started a venue, in the town that I was in, and I started booking bands coming through. Then we started booking tours and actually, you know, got to a place that, you know, every month we would do 2 or 3 shows and have a few hundred kids showing up. So I think at a very young age, I kind of realized that like, if you really love something and there's a few other people around that liked it, there's probably more. And all you kind of had to do was like build the thing that you wanted to exist. And, you know, over time, you know, it would start working out for itself. So I feel like, you know, a lot of the people I've met specifically in the photo book world very much come from that background, of skateboarding, punk rock. You know, I think it comes from like, you know, we all used to make zines as kids growing up.
Yeah.
You know, there's all this like physical tangibility. You know, a lot of us grew up doing stuff in the dark room. So there's this need to create. And for me, ironically, a lot of the people that I meet in photography, I can really boil it down to like 2 different paths as photographers. And I'm very much interested in one of those paths with everything I do with Charcoal and everything. And it's the path of people that grew up with an obsession in their life that was the thing that they loved and the thing that they were going for. And the photography was just the result of something that they loved more in their life. So like when I started taking pictures is because I love skateboarding and I wanted to photograph skateboarders. And I liked photography, but I liked it best when it was taking pictures of cool skateboarding tricks. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And kind of the same thing with bands. And like, so, and then that went into movies too. Like I love really interesting cinema and I love it when it's in service of an even better story. And so you kind of see these things and you see that like kind of the lineage, I would say that like I come from in terms of art is people who are obsessed with life. Mm-hmm. And because they're photographers, they just happen to get some pictures out of it. And, you know, I could go through almost like a whole lineage of like different photographers, you know, from like Kadelka to Degada, you know, Larry Tile. And I've personally seen that group of people dwindle smaller and smaller in the past, like I would say 20 years, mostly because they were almost all photojournalists. Living because if you're going to be a photojournalist, you're interested in a story, you're interested in a way of life. Usually you're prioritizing an experience over like a safe job. And so a lot of those people are now documentary filmmakers, they're DPs, they're cinematographers. A lot of them are still in the photo, but they're not living as photographers. You don't really know their names. And a lot of the photographers we kind of know of now are the ones who took a more institutional route, who, you know, prioritize maybe like get like landing a teaching job outside of school or like right. getting into an institution, and that's all fine. But typically the work that's made by a person who is making those life decisions is a bit more conceptual. It's a bit more safe. It's not coming out of a burning passion. It's a little bit more analytical. And so ironically for me, like I think, and this all goes back to coming from like that DIY punk rock, you're not doing something because it makes sense. You're doing it because you have to do it. And I tell people a lot, for me, being an artist, it's not a career. It's an addiction. Like I'm just a heroin addict. You know, it's like, you don't think about it and be like, oh, you know what? Like, I think I'm going to become a heroin addict because it actually makes sense for my life. Like, no, you just are, and you build your life around it. So like, I am an artist. I have to do this thing. The rest of my life is just trying to figure out how I can make those things work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually the addiction, description actually is right on target. And, you know, I scoffed with the heroin reference, but it's very true, because then you're, you know, like if it's, you know, albeit it's not a self, you know, destructive addiction, but
well, I mean, it is. Let's be honest here.
Yeah. All right.
Well, like for me, like that reference is actually a really good one, because I think so many times when you talk to artists, you hear people kind of like bitching and griping, like, oh, this person has a trust fund, or this person only gets this because of this. It's like, but none of that really matters if you all realize we're addicts, because yeah, some addicts are like CEOs of companies, or they have a trust fund so they can afford their addiction a lot easier. And some of us, like, you know, have to turn tricks on the street, or like maybe we have like an OnlyFans account. Like it doesn't matter how you get it. The only thing that matters in our life is that score. And I think that like, if you can think of it that way, it kind of demystifies a lot of this stuff. And really it takes the conversation out of like, oh, is this a viable career? It's like, well, being an addict is not a viable career. You just learn to live with it. Right, and I think the quicker people realize that, they realize that, like, I just remember meeting so many people in my life who were like artists or creatives, but they would only do things that like they could rationally make sense of, or that they would think was like a smart business decision on their end. It's like, man, none of this is a smart business decision. Like this is about doing something because you can't stop doing it. And Early on, I would tell people, like, to me, art is, it's basically just taking a shit. It's like just something you have to do every day. And if you don't, you're going to get sepsis and die. Like, it's not an option. You're not waiting around for someone to pay you to do it. You're just doing it. But if someone comes along and offers you a couple grand to like shit in a jar, like take the money. Like, yeah, that's absolutely awesome. You know, it's just like, but I think it's just that frame of reference that like, this is not about a career. Like you can build a career out of it, and some people have a better chance of doing that, but you know, it's, let's put first things first. The important thing is the desire to make. Everything else pales in comparison to that.
Yeah. And actually it's also, it's t- just as you were describing that, it is also helpful for me to also realize if you look at, you know, it's almost like you said, like if they were a trust fund or you went to a good school or they're like, you know, like a high school dropout, like just like prowling the streets and trying to, you know, turn a trick for, yeah. you know, but like, that's interesting also because, and I was aware of it when we were in Paris. So I attend Paris Photo and it's like the highest end of sort of the industry. And I know still like the photography industry, whether it's book publishing or collecting or museums and that whole world that converged on that event. It's still, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge world that.
Oh, it's incredibly small. Right. It, like, you know, you, if you're in that world, like, you know, you go to those events and, you know, I've only been going to the physical events for a few years. But I mean, I would say you know, or recognize a fourth of the people there, you know, it's a small world. And I think that's also something kind of fun that again, relates back to music is like, you know, I grew up playing heavy metal and you're not in those industries because you think you're going to be a multimillionaire selling artist. Like you are doing it because every town you go to, you see familiar faces, you see friends. And like, I think sometimes when people think about like the opportunity to be successful as an artist, it can be depressing when you think it's a small industry. There's not like, you know, there's not like rock star money in it, but then you realize like, no, it actually gives you the ability to know the people that support you, that when people support you and buy your books or they buy prints or, you know, they go to your events, they're doing it because they trust you. Like they're investing in you as an artist. And I think that that's like, I love that. Like, I love it being a small world where like people can actually get to know who you are and like, become part of like your trajectory as an artist and what you're producing in the way that like, you know, in the 70s, you could basically do that with filmmakers, you know, before tons of money from studios and stuff came in, you know, people were just kind of making stuff that they liked. And because it was a small world, you're making stuff that is interesting to you. So it's just a more fascinating world to be in.
Yeah. And well, it's several things that what you said just is sparking for me. First of which is so I'm at Paris Photo and like, you know, Bruce Gilden goes walking by and I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, like, you know,
yeah,
in the grand scheme of things, not a big deal. But then in our world, like, oh shit, there's Bruce Gilden or that, you know, but then to just sort of, you know, dig down a little deeper, Polycopies, which to me was more like that, fell completely into my wheelhouse and sort of like my just mindset and also aesthetic. But, you know, like I'm just walking by and I see you and I didn't know you, but I knew Charcoal Press because, you know, like I'm in, that's our world. I mean, like, and so it's not even like, oh, well, I wonder if like, if I knew somebody who could introduce me to this person,
right?
So like, we just like, it's one degree of separation really. And then that sort of world or that community, which I think also sort of leeches its way back into like the Paris Photo echelon. But then, you know, there's a lot of the same people who were signing or showing work at Paris Photo also had something going on at Polycopies.
Yeah.
And so,
Because Polycopies is like, you know, it's book focused, you know, so Paris Photo is still very much about selling prints, but I mean, this has been like my whole trajectory of even just learning about so much of this stuff is that like, I feel like I've found that like, I love prints, right? Like, you know, I trade prints with people, I make silver prints. But prints are not really made for normal people to own anymore, right? They used to be. And that's why even like I do this whole thing called Charcoal Editions, which is all about being able to buy affordable silver prints that are not edition. So Paris Photo is that like, yeah, it's like it's people still operating in a model that I feel like it's existing less every year. And it's also just a world that like I don't understand the motivations for. Like people buy prints for reasons I would never buy them. Right. So like if I buy a print, it's because I find that print beautiful and I want to live with that print every single day on my wall. Collectors and stuff are like, they're buying things so they can then donate them to a museum after they retire so they can get a tax write-off, mm-hmm. right? Like there's like much more kind of like money laundering aspects to like the print world and the gallery world that I don't really understand. Like I love galleries. I love having stuff shown there. It's just a world that doesn't actually make sense to me. It's like the stock market, honestly. Like that's how I think of it. Like, it's like, it doesn't make sense. I know some people that know how to play it. I just am not that person. And so for me, like, yeah, Polycopies and stuff makes more sense because like people like me buy books. It's what we do. As you can see, like I like books is what I can afford. It was my beginning connection to photography or all things artistic were through books. Never grew up in places that had, you know, museums or anything like that. So my entire evolution as an artist has been because of books. And I think that like when you realize that like that's the people that are interested in my work are people like me, people that feel emotionally connected with work, you just realize like, okay, well, like this is me playing to my audience. This is making stuff. This is like making albums, right? Mm-hmm. Like making a book is like making an album. Going to Polycopies is like going to like a music festival that's like specific for your genre. And then, yeah, then like, you know, Paris Photo is like, it's like the thing that like, maybe you get asked to like host the Grammys. So it's like, it doesn't really make sense to me. You know, it's like, I think a lot of these like little subcultures, like you can pull out, like whether it's music or even if you think like stand-up comedy, it's like, it's very similar to what we're doing because like what you were saying, how you can just like walk through a room and see Bruce Gill and you can see these people. It's like, you know, you can go to a music festival and there's thousands of people and you get to see your favorite band, but then like 2 days later, they could be playing a show for 100 people or less, you know? And it's like, that's kind of the reality of the situation. That's why those events are really good, because it really does bring everybody together in the one kind of cohesive space so we can like fill out a venue. And I think that's like, that's kind of one of the really fun things about those events is you kind of realize that like, you know, Polycopies is like a punk rock show. Paris Photo is like a symphony, both awesome, both have very different clientele. So you kind of figure out where you want to be. My favorite thing about Paris Photo and any of those events is walking through and just getting ideas of how to frame things. It's so good for that. And also like just so cool to get up that close to images you've only ever seen, you know, printed in a book. And, you know, sometimes you're just blown away by the printing. And other times you're like, I can't believe that this is hanging on the wall here. This is printed awful. Yeah. I can't believe they're okay with that. Yeah. It's eye opening.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right in line with the way you're describing it. And then like the other downside of you know, so you're navigating Parry Photo and like that, what you described is sort of like the stock market-esque kind of investor speculative sort of collecting. And that's just sort of like the bigger art world completely operates like that. And so then it just like, that's the photo world version of it.
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, so many of the people that are collectors are people that like made a lot of money playing the stock market, you know, a lot of money investing in things. Like they're not, it's not, you do, I don't want to like blanket statement. You do definitely find like wealthy people that understand art and support specific artists. But I think the vast majority of it, it is a way to, you know, put assets into something that can be donated later on for, like, again, like none of that way of keeping like record financial records or business makes any sense to me. I mean, I'm glad it exists. And like, you know, there was a very big photo collector in Cleveland who just donated their entire collection to the Cleveland Museum of Art. And like, that's awesome. But you realize like, oh, like, so that was what they were building up to for the last 20 years of collecting. They were building a collection that was valued at a certain amount, then that's donation to a nonprofit. And I think for me, it's like, I'm never talking about these things because I feel like it's bad. It's just, I think it's good for artists to understand what the rules of the game is. Right. Yeah. So like, I remember growing up just thinking like, if you made beautiful, awesome work that like institutions would be interested in collecting. It's like, well, the people that are collecting at those places are not necessarily looking at work the way that I look at it as an artist. They're not looking at it being like, oh my gosh, like this body of work made me cry. Like they're looking at like who the artist is. Like, is this going to play well with our donors? Is the board going to like this? Are they going to approve this budget? You know, there's like a million other things to think about. And same thing with like any sort of collecting. So I feel like it's really good to have conversations about like how the games work, so you know how to play them. And if you're someone who's like coming from like a punk rock background, you're not going to expect that you're going to get invited to play at the Super Bowl, right? Like you just know, it's like, hey, if it happens, it's cool. But like my track is doing underground shows. My track is playing bowling. It's like, you know, the path that you're on. So you don't feel like, well, if I was doing this, I could be getting this. Or just like, why am I not getting what other people are getting? It's like, well, you're playing soccer, they're playing basketball. Like it's just a different game.
Yeah. Let me ask you about charcoal. So, and I'm just going to say charcoal as a blanket statement.
Octopus.
Right. Well, you mentioned earlier that you were involved in a separate kind of publishing endeavor before this. Was charcoal first and foremost the imprint? Is that where it started?
So the company I used to do before is called the Collective Quarterly, and basically that was like where I cut my teeth, like working with a bunch of people, started publishing. And when I discovered photo books, I realized that that's where my passion was. And so we were kind of starting to wind that thing down. I didn't want to travel anymore the way we had been traveling for like 5 or 6 years straight, basically. Actually, right before I moved to Ohio, my family, my wife and I and our first three boys lived in an Airstream for almost 2 years traveling North America doing that. Wow. It was pretty exhausting. So
yeah, I bet.
When I started charcoal, it actually started out as the book club. That was the idea. And one of the reasons that I had the idea is from publishing a quarterly, which ironically was never actually a quarterly. At best, we ever did 2 issues in a year. It just always took longer. Was I got tired of having to constantly remind people to buy our new thing. And I saw this as a very big problem with books. And this kind of constant ask for funding. And I realized, I was like, well, I just want to convince people like one time to pay attention. And then it's my job to not fuck up, right? Mm. Like it's my job at that point to constantly do well. I don't have to constantly remind them, hey, like go online, like, you know, your subscription's almost running out, like reapply. Cause what you found is like so many people love what you're doing, but they're just busy and I'm busy, you know? So I really got tired of doing that. And I've always been very good at being like seeing myself in the third person and just being very realistic about like what's possible. And I just remember thinking, okay, and this was the same reason I started my own magazine. Like, I knew that no one would pay me to go and do the stories I wanted to do because I was an unknown photographer and I wanted to do stuff that magazines wouldn't pay you to go do. Like go to really rural, really small places and do a huge photojournalism project about like a place that like didn't even have tourism dollars, right? Mm-hmm. For advertising. So in the same way with charcoal, it's like, well, if I'm going to be, you know, printing books and also like, you know, curating, I need to have the audience that trusts me and trusts the curation, right? And I think that like that was just very apparent from the very beginning. And also it was at the same time as realizing that the books that I was finding that I loved, nobody was talking about. And they were not obscure books. These were like really amazing books, but like the quote unquote like voices within like, you know, the photo world were just, again, interested in things I wasn't interested in. They were interested in the concept of the project. They're interested in who the artist was. They're interested in all these things. And like, I was like, yeah, but the photos suck. Like the book is cool, but the photos are terrible. Like, I don't understand why people are talking about this. So the idea from the beginning was like, well, I'm going to start my own club. And I'm going to basically over time filter down to where the people that are on board are people that either like the taste and curation that we're doing or are along for the ride, right? It's just like being a radio DJ or anything else. Like over time they trust you. And I knew that like publishing was ultimately one of the goals of that, but I needed to have that structure because one of the problems you get into when you're publishing is money, right? So I always found it pretty like reprehensible that like publishers ask artists to pay for their books, right? And that is common practice. Like we're one of the few publishers that pay for the production. But I also know that like when I make a book with someone, like I am heavily involved in that process. Like it's at least a 1 to 2 year process. It's very intensive. Like I'm making a book that I am willing to put my name on with them. And it's the same way like Jack Witte was with Twin Palms, where like he made his books with their work. I don't go to that extreme with it because, you know, you would just like send them your work and get a book 10 years later. But like, I think that like, for me, it's like, well, if I want to be able to push an artist to their full potential, I need to be putting my money where my mouth is. I need to be the one saying like, look, I will cover this, but you need to work for another 2 years on this, you know, and like really push the artist. Cause a lot of projects are not taken to their fullest extent because the project's good enough, the publisher's not paying for it. And so from day one, you're in profit, because if you sell 5 copies, you're going to be quote unquote profitable. And most people who are publishers are not doing it to make a living. You know, it's a fun thing they do on the side. So all of the incentives are lined up in a weird way. And what that filters down to is like, if you want to make a book, you have to fundraise, and you can usually fundraise for your first book. But after that, like you really can't keep that going. Yeah. So just in terms of like trajectory early on, I was like, okay, the biggest goal is to have not only resources that you can put towards printing books from unknown artists, but also to have like a fan base that when you do that, that's their favorite books. And the only way to do that is like to have people that, you know, that kind of ongoingly trust your creation, and kind of everything else like has stemmed out from that. Actually, ironically, we were doing our event, the Chico Review, before I started Charcoal. It was a little bit more photojournalistic back then. That's why it has a completely different name. But kind of all these things play together. Cause like basically in like the one company, you know, we have like, you know, I always think of like the book club is almost like our street cred arm of it. You know, it's like, we're almost never doing books that financially make sense for the model, but there are ones that are necessary and like interesting. And so we always go with that. And then we also have, you know, the publishing, which is kind of in the same thing. And then, you know, the events is where you're able to make more resources to fund all that other stuff too. So you kind of like realize like, oh, this is one octopus. It just has 10 different arms like any other business. And you know what is for building community, and you know what is for resources, and you know what's for you know, having the kind of trust with your audience where they're willing to trust you when you do big stuff like events or a publishing endeavor.
Yeah. Let me let me jump back to so the book club, and the fact that which I didn't realize is that the artists aren't paying, you're paying to put the book out, which does, I mean, that again, this weird model of you know, photographers having to foot the bill to have their book published by somebody else.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it does make sense when you're in it, because you realize that most books won't sell.
Sure. But again, it's like there's distribution and there's, you know, like production concerns. I get that part of it, but also, and maybe this is just my reaction again, because I do all of that shit myself, at a very, small scale. But like, I think it also feeds on this sort of vanity, component of photographers who like, well, I'm not good. Like the book is some sort of like milestone or that like I'm legitimate now. And those sort of pay to play approaches feed on that. Not everybody. Yeah. And you know, that's a broad stroke statement, but like, it does feel to me that it's like, well, there's going to be people lining up to keep that model going. And that it's refreshing to hear that you don't do it that way.
And like, I always preface it by, I think that there are models for everyone, right? Cause like, I know some artists that are, they're older and have like huge bodies of work and they have money, but they don't have the ability to translate their stuff into a book. And they don't really have the ability to sell the book or to go to Polycopies or Paris Photo and like have a table. So I feel like sometimes like it is a good exchange between people. Cause ultimately you're paying for design studio to produce a book for you. That being said, I've always operated under the thing of like anything I do, I want to build like the offer I always wish I got from someone else. Like you always dream about like, oh, like I want like X person to publish my book and it'd be awesome if they just came to me and saw my brilliance and said that like, oh, we want to publish this great thing. Like, don't worry about it. I was like, oh, I want to be able to do that for people. And I want to be able to come to it and also like, you know, a lot of times have more experience making and even just looking at books than most artists do. And so being able to come to me like, hey, I think this work has a lot of potential. I'm going to commit to publishing this book, but we're going to work on it for 3 years, probably at least. And then it becomes like a mentorship. And I like doing that because I like, in the same way I used to like helping produce other bands' records, like I like helping other people see what is there that they don't see. Because so many times, like artists are infatuated with what they're trying to do and they're not really aware of what they are doing. And so many times, like you see this in portfolio reviews or when you're looking through like a big body of work, you'll see that the work that someone's presenting, it's almost always kind of like you kind of have already seen the work before and it's not very interesting because it's what they're trying to emulate. It's what they're trying to do. But if you look deep into their work, like half the time they're doing something more interesting. They're just not listening to their work. You know, they're telling their work what it needs to be. Mm. They're not listening to what it wants to be. And I think that like, it's such an obvious thing when you look at a lot of work over and over and over again, or you see almost every book comes out, like it becomes very clear the artists or the publishers, they're able to listen to work and kind of bring out the best parts of it. And I think that like, that's something that is difficult, but really good to do with especially young artists and like first time artists, because I just, especially doing book club, like there's so many books published and the vast majority of them are not interesting. I always tell people like whether there was 12 books printed in a year or like 12,000, there probably is only 10 great books a year or less. Mm-hmm. And you know, we are seeing more and more books being published, but we're not seeing more and more fantastic books being published. I would say we're probably seeing less. And it's usually just because there isn't as many filters, or like the publishers don't have as much of incentive to be hard and say like, no, this isn't good enough. We need to keep going. You need to keep shooting. Because they don't really have that much at stake. And mm-hmm. a lot of times they're kind of like not calling the shots because they're not paying for it. So you can't make those like those hard edit choices that you need to make sometimes. And then also like the photographer, yeah, it's easier for them to do it. So they're a little bit more quick to put something out, thinking it's going to be a stepping stone to getting a show or something. But they're not thinking of that as being the pinnacle of what they're doing. So it'd be like a band releasing a bunch of albums just so they could tour or just so they could like get a festival show. It's like, no, the album is the thing. You need to focus on making a fantastic album. If you make an incredible album, the other stuff will come. This is not a stepping stone to get somewhere. This is the thing. Everything else is, you know, downhill from here.
Yeah. And to make the sort of the correlation between, you know, like the music industry and the photo book industry, but the like what you are describing for Charcoal Press and the book club is almost like a label, like a music label that
that's exactly what I say all the time. Like I do think of everything down to our credits in the back of the book are music credits. Like every book is produced by me. It's not just like sequence. It's like, no, that like I'm doing the role of a producer, like the way Rick Rubin sits in the studio and helps put riffs together with bands to create songs. Like that's the role. And I mean, that's our entire structure for like where money goes into the stuff. Cause like you know, most publishing companies will have the artist pay, but then they make the money off of it, right? And again, it's like, I understand why that is, because most don't make money. But for us, it's like, well, if we're going to make the money, I should be at risk, because I have a greater incentive to A, make sure it's fantastic, and B, really hustle it and make sure it sells. And that's better for the artist. And then all that money goes back into all the other books we're producing. Like, some books don't sell as well, but they're important because it actually brings it brings more credibility to the label as a whole, which benefits everyone on the label. And so, like, you really do have to think of it that way. There are strategic moves that you make that, like, some books are more kind of street cred books, and other books are more like, you know, they're going to sell a little bit more because a person's more popular. And you don't ever do it for those things, but you see that everyone plays a role, right? Same thing, like, you know, members in a band, like, everyone has a role to play. And if you can see it that way, then it makes sense. Then it is like being part of a team together, which I think is really the only way to make something kind of lasting, kind of in this, like, really small, kind of weird, esoteric, you know, world that we live in.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you know, that idea of, you know, you are at the helm of something that, you know, you are very conscious of, like, where a project can fit in that makes sense from a sort of like the audience standpoint. Well,
yeah,
you know, here, this is important work. You might not know about it. This is why I want you to see it. This is where it fits in the grand scheme of things. Also, like, you know, it's almost like, to, again, to the metaphor of a label, it's like, okay, well, you know, like, I was, you know, grew up on like indie rock, right? So if something is coming, you know, something's coming out on Matador, I'm probably going to like it, even if I don't even know who the band is. Like,
yeah.
But like,
you're at least going to give it a listen.
Yeah. Yeah. And more often than not, I do like it. I mean, you know, so but that ends up becoming like, yes, I'm a fan of a specific band and they're on that label, but also I trust the people who are running the label to only, you know, bring on and share things that are up to that sort of standard that they've established.
With that, with labels, like, especially, like, you know, like, small labels, right? We're not talking about like huge pop labels or anything like that. Like, you're making investments in a band because of the music, not because of what you think they're going to do commercially. Like, yeah, you hope that they do well, and some bands do, but you also know it's more to your benefit to know what your audience is interested in and bring in things that they haven't heard. Right.
Right.
And so, like, that really is the same exact mentality. And, like, I tell people a lot, cause, you know, you always get pitch projects, and it's like, man, like, I like to think of, like, what we're doing is, like, we are very much like a heavy metal record label. Like, there's softer acts and there's heavier acts, but, like, I like to think of that as, like, the aesthetic of what we're doing, or, you know, punk rock, or just, like, underground, right? Like, emotion led. Like, so when, like, I'm probably not going to produce a country music record. There might be a band like that's the thing I always loved about, like, Jack White and some of these other, like, musicians, like, who they could, like, they will find a country music act that fully fits within, like, the punk rock genre. Like, I remember touring with bands that would, like, tour with, like, hip hop artists and stuff like that, but they were always like, almost like, this is basically the same music, just like in a parallel universe. And I feel like that really becomes a fun thing when you know, like, what you're doing and what your aesthetics and what your kind of, like, atmosphere is, and you're able to pull people that people don't expect to actually really do fit within that genre, even if it's not the same aesthetics. But then also, you really can tell people, it's like, hey, this is great work. It just does not fit on our label. Like, I think that's something that's, like, important for photographers to realize, because, like, so many times you just get people walking up to you, be like, hey, I want you to publish my book. And it's like, do you even know the bands that we produce? It's like, you know, like, this is a genre. Like, we have a specific aesthetic, and it goes back to, it's because I have to like it to work on it. And if I'm going to work on it for 2 or 3 years, I have to be excited to wake up every day and look at the work. And if it's not within my realm of things I get excited for. I can't put in the time and emotion into a body of work that does nothing for me inside. It's not true to me, and it's not true to work. I think that, like, you know, if you're not making tons of money in it, like doing something, you need to go with stuff that like that turns you on. And I think that that's like, again, going back to these like pay for play models, I think that's why we don't get a lot of books that are like truly engaging, is like the incentives for the people working on are not aligned with this work makes me so excited. I've been working on it for 2 years and I still love looking at it. It's like, that's what a book needs to be. If a book is not interesting to look at 2 years after you have it, then you fucking wasted your money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I remember, I forget who said it. It actually might've been like Stephen King in his book On Writing, which I think is like one of the best books ever written. I always tell people it's the best books about photography that's not about photography that you can read. But it talks about, it's like, you know, if you spend, you know, a couple thousand dollars on a painting, but yet it brings you a lifetime of enjoyment and mystery and catching it out of the corner of your eye and it makes you smile, then like that was a good investment. If you spend $5 on something that you look at one time and throw away, like you wasted your money. And I feel like that really is kind of a concept within the book world, because so many books that come out, I feel like people think of it as like, well, I did this project, now it has to be a book. It's like,
yeah,
does it? Like, I don't think I always think it's like, I have my work hanging up around me, because the reason I make my work is because I need my work to survive in this world. Like, if someone else made it, I wouldn't have to. I would look at theirs. Mm-hmm. But no one's making what I need, so I'm making it. And if you're your first test subject and you don't like looking at your own work, how can you expect anyone else to? Like, I always find this like amazing when I talk to people. I'm like, you know, they act like they don't even like their work. I'm like, do you think anyone else is going to buy something and live with it for an entire life if you don't like it? Like, you have to get high on your own supply. If you don't, like, I think it's like almost disingenuous to expect someone else to. And I think that, like, again, like this just goes back to these like incentive structures where it's like, you know, if you're just producing books because you want your name to be on books or you want to have it out there so you can get gallery shows, it's like, well, you want people to spend money on this thing that you just think is kind of this stepping stone somewhere else. Like,
yeah,
it needs to be the pinnacle of something. It needs to have a piece of your soul in it. Otherwise, like, why would I keep it around?
Yeah. Again, and going back to what I said earlier, a vanity project, it's ego driven, or it
well,
is
I mean, all of artists are vanity projects. If you think about it, it's like, again, I think this is like the weird thing, especially coming from more of a commercial background and like doing, you know, everything I do is a for profit. I think that so many times as artists, especially with the way that things are set up with like, it's hard to like make a living being an artist. So most people don't even think about the customer side. They only think, I want to do this thing. People should pay me to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think that like from the very beginning, if you can have the mindset of saying like, well, I want to do this thing, but how can I make it valuable to other people to either have me do it or for them to be a part of this thing? If you can just think that little bit different, you're going to approach it differently, because you're not going to come into saying like, well, you should just pay me to do what I want to do. It's like, well, what value are you bringing to my life? Now, if I can pay you and you're going to bring me years of like beauty and intrigue and mystery and insight into my life through you, through transcending being yourself and doing something truly universal, then yeah, absolutely. But if all you're going to do is just kind of like, you know, talk more about yourself, it's like, that's not bringing anything to me. And like, I feel like that's like something too, even with like grant structures and the way that all this stuff set up, it's set up to basically just encourage people to do that. Like, I want to do this thing, someone else should like pay for me to do it. And again, going, that goes back to this addiction thing. No one ever said like, man, I really want to be a heroin addict. I just really wish someone would pay me to do it. It's like, no, you just do the thing. You figure it out later on. I feel like so many of these things boil back down to that same point where it is mostly vanity. And especially the way that things are set up now, I feel like a lot of the people are doing things for reasons outside of vanity. Like, they're doing it because they love doing the thing. You're just not really hearing about them. Like, a lot of the people I'm working with right now are not people that ever went to photo school, you never actually meet them. They're people that like I literally accidentally bumped up to into like years ago on like an island and just discovered their work. Like they're too busy being a dad or being a lobster fisherman, but they're an amazing photographer and they were shooting like, you know, Kodachrome slides in like the 80s. It's just like this incredible body of work. Like those are the people I'm interested in. Because they're not just trying to be an artist. They just are an artist. Mm-hmm. But they're more interested in the things that bring them excitement in their life than they are about like being perceived as an artist.
Well, let's I want to use that as a bridge to you. And
yeah. And sorry if I'm all over the place with my responses.
I love it. Actually. I'm like, this could be a 2-hour episode because.
I always tell people I can't talk in an hour segment.
Yeah. You're dropping like so much like relevant. Like I was like, how can I like, can I have like a little sound that says like, here's another fucking truth bomb right now that you're sharing. But what I'd like to do, though, is to use your last statement as sort of bridge to you and your own photography and your work. Because, and I want to preface this by saying that I wasn't familiar with your work when we met. Your book was one of several on your table. And the first thing you described it as is sort of like this multi-volume concept. And I was like, all right, so this guy's got like this whole sort of like future for this project thought out. And I was like, well, what is this and what is it about? And then through the conversation, you know, like you're a family man, you've got 6 kids, which I find like, I can't believe you do anything else. The work, as you described it, revolves around your family. So let's talk about you as that artist,
Well, and just even to touch on the series. So yeah, so it's a 7-book series called The 7 Seals, like the 7 Seals of the Apocalypse. You know, that wasn't the idea originally. Like everything I do, it's always very reactionary. Like I started off as a collage artist. So I feel like everything I do is just kind of like looking at what's available and figuring out the best thing I can do with it. And, you know, I have 6 kids. The reason I started making this work is because I wanted to only photograph things I loved. Because I got tired of doing stuff I just didn't care about. And so, you know, I was working on my first book, and realized that like the amount of shooting I do, like realistically, I'm ready for a book about every 4 years. And when I kind of did the math, I was like, a book every 4 years, the last book would come out right as my twins, which are my youngest, they're 2 years old, will come out right as they graduate high school. And to me, it was kind of like a perfect bookends for this work. Cause like, you know, my hope is that this work continues to go on. And I do it with grandkids, and it's just, because it's just part of my life. Like I just want to be around things I love. And, but it also, it gives an interesting like concept. And the reason I chose the 7 seals, cause in Abrahamic mythology, like once that 7th seal is read, the whole world is destroyed in the apocalypse, but mm-hmm. then it's also rebirthed again. Right. And so like when my kids are all gone, this life I will have known for 30 years will be destroyed. Like everything I would have become used to will be different now. It will be rebirth, but it will be a different thing. It will be, you know, new life born out of destruction. And so I felt like that was just a very good way to wrap my head around like what my job as my kids are growing up is as an artist. Like my job obviously is to be a dad, but I'm someone who like I needed like an artistic reason to be doing things. Like everything I do, I have to like have a camera with me to feel like I'm actually doing something, you know? Mm-hmm. And so for me, even just like hanging out with my kids or walking or foraging for food or looking for, you know, for birds, like, yes, it's, I want to do it, but it's the justification. I have a camera with me. This is my job now too. So it gives me the time that I need to be able to do that. And that was really the thinking behind it, because I never really liked family work. You know, I was fascinated with travel and exotic things. The first photo book I ever bought was actually, the Taschen collection of all Peter Beard's work. Mm. And when I moved to Ohio, I really kind of came to grips with the fact I had three kids. I was tired of traveling. And I was like, I don't understand like why I'm flying to Newfoundland to photograph people in their houses and their animals. Like when I have all those things here, you know, it doesn't look, it's not easy, right? That was actually one of my biggest frustrations with the Midwest is like, it's very subtle. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up, you know, being from out West, like I always wanted to go out West or go live on islands because like, it's just, it's exciting to look at for me. And one of the things I realized when I realized that my work was right in front of me is that like my job as an artist was to find a way to see my world as if it was a movie I would want to live in. That like the job is to find a way to see it to where it excites you. And through seeing it in a way that excites you, it actually excites the real thing as well. So like in my books, you know, there's, you know, it's all black and white, which really helps me because kids have horrible choices in color. it's terrible. But also it allows me to like to punch past it a little bit and see it as like a Bilitar film, like something that like I find very aesthetically interesting, and get past some of the normal day aspect of it. But also, you know, like I grew up a missionary kid. My dad was a pastor and a missionary, and grew up very like pretty fundamentalist Christian. And when I kind of, you know, deconstructed a lot of my faith, like I felt like I lost this magical aspect to my daily life where this kind of bigger cosmic thing going on. And like this feeling, like I think magic's the easiest, maybe enchantment's better. Right. And I discovered that as I was making my first book, that really digging into nature was a way that brought that enchantment back to my life, because I started noticing things that I had always thought of in a literal fashion in religion or spirituality that were actually true figuratively or like literarily, not literally. Mm-hmm. So like even the title for the new book, The Seraphim, you know, that refers to like the highest order of angel in Jewish and Christian mythology, which is, it's like a six-winged beast that was covered with eyes on the inside. And it's like very beautiful and destructive. And to me, I always thought of that when I was out in the woods and I would see an owl. Because I always go and look for owls. And, you know, when you see one, like you see it because they let you see them. They know you're coming from miles away. So if you see one, it's because they presented themselves to you. Just like in, you know, in stories where like angels would appear to people, the first thing they always say is don't be afraid, because it was terrifying. And they'd always be presenting themselves. So I always thought that then, and also like, there's this interesting thing, like, especially with owls and birds of prey in general, is like, they are beautiful creatures. They're apex predators, you know, like they are crazy and they can do some damage, but they're also incredibly beautiful. So there's this like real kind of like two aspects about them. And then, you know, I started finding like, angel, like I started thinking of them as angels, because I was like, you know, it's crazy, they literally live in the same world that we live in, but we can only see them when they let us see them, right? Like they're like, and then all of a sudden, like I started, you know, through making this work and through seeing these motifs that I like I started actually feeling that like normal life was closer to like a fairy tale than even I could have hoped it to be if these things were like actually physically real, right? Because all of a sudden I realized that like walking through the woods anywhere, like even if you're just like at like a rest stop on that highway, like I've found like owl nests in like the woods next to him. I've found, you know, beautiful mushrooms that you can eat growing in those places. Like you just realize like there are these little kind of magical microcosms all over the place. And like everything can kind of be a scavenger hunt almost. And that's the way you feel like when you're taking pictures, but then you realize like there are these things and like there are truly transcendent experiences that you can have just by observing nature, and that like those things are worth your time. You know, I think in photography a lot, especially again, going back to like, I think a lot of the people that are interested in this, like the experiences aspect of photography have moved on to other things. But I feel for me, I want to live in a world that's full of magic, right? That like, that feels that way when I walk around. And finding things worth looking at are key to that. So many photographs, it's like a magic trick, right? Mm-hmm, they're like, hey, look at this cool picture I can make out of nothing, right? Like the way I photograph this empty place is cool because it has like, you know, has the golden ratio and it's engaging. But at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, man, it's still a fucking picture of nothing. Like that always bugged me because I was like, there's so many things worth looking at that you're taking time specifically not looking at them. Like in that same, like you're photographing trash on the side of the street and trying to do it in a beautiful way, but you're like not even looking at the rat that's running across it. You're like, and I always thought about these things. Like I always wanted everything I photographed to be something I would point to one of my kids and say, hey, look at that. Like, hey, look, there's an owl in that tree. Like, look at this like little, this little nest over here. I never once have walked through a field and say, hey, look at that tree. There's nothing in it. You know, it's always like, right. No, there's always something to look at there. And it was actually really funny because this little 6-year-old girl at Polycopies brought her dad over, who's one of the guys who runs it. And she looked through my new book. She like grabbed him because she had already looked through it. And she went through page by page, pointing out every single like animal and insect in the book. Mm-hmm. And she was like giggling and stuff. And to me, it's like, that's really kind of what my work is. It's like a seek and find book for kids a lot of times. But I feel that like if you're always looking for something like that, it really does make every day incredibly fascinating because like so many interesting, weird little things happen if you're simply out in the world looking. Just most of us aren't really looking. And so I don't really know how I got into that conversation with it, but like, oh, like when I started doing all these things, I just realized that there's so much more existing with us in life than like what we think of when we just think like in our kind of like, you know, postmodern, you know, kind of modernity kind of thing, like humans first, society, all these things, we kind of miss out on these bigger things that are actually the way you relate to a world when you're a kid. When you're a kid, everything's worth your time. Yeah. Watching ants walk for 2 hours is worth your time. When we get older, it's like, well, it's not worth my time. It's not paying me. I need to like go and talk to humans about human things. You miss the things that have always enchanted humans. Like when you think about animistic cultures and you think about like what we drew in caves, it's like it was profound spiritual experiences had with nature, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like to me, this entire process of going through this has just like deepened my own world of living. Because when I'm photographing these things I find magical, like an owl nest, and like watching a baby great horned owl like grow and fledge, and then photographing these like beautiful mushrooms we find, and then my kids playing, you know, art is all about like condensing and distilling, right? And so when I distill all those things down and I make a book and I look through the book, I'm like, God damn, this looks like a grim fairy tale. Like all of the elements in fairy tales are right here. Yeah. And then it blows my mind because I'm like, they were all physically here because I photographed those things all where I live. So all of the elements to build actual magic is here. And going back to what I was saying earlier, it's like, for me, so much of like modern photography is like a magic trick. It's like a card trick. It's like sleight of hand. It's like, look at this cool thing I can do that like, it tricks you to thinking there's magic. It's like, I feel like what I'm doing and like the work that I really love is like actually showing it, like, no, there's actual magic. Like, this is not a card trick. This is real. And that to me is very exciting because it deepens, I think, like, the well you're pulling from, if that makes sense. And for me, especially the way I was brought up, like I need that. Like it's why like my books and stuff, it's connected to mythology and to kind of these bigger, you know, mine's connected very much to like a Christian backup, because to me that's the quickest way to get to this like deep kind of blood memory, this like history of like prophecy, because that's the mindset I want people to be in. I don't want people to think of my work as just like photographing my kids. I want it to feel biblical. Like I want it to feel apocryphal, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the tradition I come from, right? And even the way I talk, like I talk in analogies. Like that's the way my dad talks as a pastor. Like everything's an analogy. Like I very much have that. Yeah. So anyway, so like I think that's kind of the full spectrum of just like that's how the work started. It really was necessary for me to make this work to be able to be okay living here, because it was helping me see this place as beautiful and magical. And now going into the second book, it's going deeper into that. And like, to me, I feel like I can just make this work the rest of my life because it's always about finding deeper mysteries, like where I live. And it's like the reason I'm photographing owls is not because, or birds of prey is not because like I want them as motifs. It's because I want an experience with them. Like it's one of the things that bugs me when like a lot of photographers photograph wildlife or mushrooms or anything like that, because so many times they want the photo, they don't want the experience.
Yeah.
Right. So they'll go to a raptor center and photograph like an owl on a glove, or they'll use motion sensing cameras and a camera trap to photograph something. For me, it's about the experience. It's like, it's why I use the cameras I use, is like, even with like a long lens, I only use like a 400 millimeter on like an old Leica with no image stabilization, no autofocus, because that's the closest that I've found you can get to a lot of these birds before they'll fly away. Mm. So it gets you as close as possible, but then it still renders it in a way that feels the way that you see it with your eyes. Like this idea of like getting all the way up and just getting this close crop view of someone, like an owl's face, is like, well, you're never going to see that in real life unless you're at a zoo. You're always going to see it in context to being 50 feet away or farther. And I find that really interesting. And it's why, like, I mean, to me, I can really geek out on a lot of the photos. Like one of my favorite photos in the new book is the square picture of this baby barred owl up in the tree. And one of the reasons I geek out about it so much personally is because I shot it with a Rolleiflex. Like I was 15 feet away from this baby barred owl. I had just tore my ACL. I was on crutches wading through a swamp. and I got just eaten alive by mosquitoes that day. But it was such an amazing experience that it allowed me to get that close to him and share this moment with it. And like that photo is the result. Like that is the, like, that's the takeaway for me. You know, it wasn't the goal. The goal was just to be as close to something magical as possible. And I think that, like, for me, that applies to all the things. That applies to my children, that applies to like the mushrooms. And I think too, like, I think it gives dignity to all these things to pay that much attention. It gives dignity to a praying mantis to think it's worth the time to take a portrait of it, right? I think that's something that we really miss when we get older, is like, I always think, like, if you look at a kid's book, like if my photos were a kid's book, every single animal that shows up would have a speaking part, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because they're important characters to the story. And so many times we, like, I'll look through photo books and it's just all, you know, people and buildings. And it's like, within those structures, there's a million things that aren't people that are living, that are the things you hear when you walk by. You hear cicadas, you know, you hear bees, you hear crickets, you hear all these things. And when you don't have them in books, you're missing a soundtrack. You know, like to me, all these little tiny elements in the book, like the bee reel, is what builds the atmosphere that the world lives in. If I don't get any of that, then it, like in my head, it just sounds like a neon light in a room with somebody in it. It's like, this is not magical at all. This is like, you know, this is like Andy Warhol chewing a mushroom in front of a camera for 4 hours. Like, I'm just not interested in that.
Right. That actually was a really powerful statement, bringing the dignity to what's in the picture. To me, that is so profound, and something that a lot of us, you know, need to be reminded of, I think.
Well, the conversation for the last, like, you know, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years, I don't know how long it's been going on. It's like people only talk about photography as taking something. I think it gives more than it takes. Like, and granted, like, you know, there's special cases for everything, but like, I grew up traveling to different cultures and everything. And I have never gone to a place that if you show a genuine love and interest of the people of the culture or anything, that they don't welcome you in. Like, people are excited when you care about who they are, where they are, and why they're there. And I always found that as like the really disingenuous thing when photographer, or like when people talk about it, it's like, anytime I hear someone talking about like, oh, you shouldn't go in there, you're not from there, you can't photograph those people. It's like, well, clearly you've never traveled. You've never gone to a place you don't belong and been welcomed in, because that actually happens pretty fucking often. Mm-hmm. If you go, like, even like, you know, I was in bands, like I remember so many times, like I tell people that, like, if you want to be blown away by the goodness of the world, put yourself at its risk. Like, go on a hiking, you know, like hike the Appalachian Trail. You'll come across more people that want to help you than want to hurt you. You kind of just got to put yourself out there like that. And I think that, like, with photography, yeah, I think we think of it, you know, because we're photographers, so we're always thinking about like what we get out of it. But, you know, you're giving a lot when you think someone's interesting enough, and not even like beautiful, you just think someone's compelling enough to stop and to look at them and to listen to them and to photograph them. That brings something to the person. It doesn't just take away. And I think that, like, to me, even with my kids, like, people ask me like, well, what if your kids don't want to be photographed? It's like, well, I mean, my kids don't want to brush their fucking teeth. You know, like, there's lots of things they don't want, but they want to spend time with me, and they want me to view them, and they want me to see them, and they want me to do these things. So I think that there's a lot of different types of currency that photography has. And I think, like, the biggest thing it does, I do think it, if you're doing it genuinely, then I think it gives dignity to what you're viewing. Of course, there's been people that take that out of context and they're exploitative, but I think for the most of us, I think we're viewing things that we want to view. And again, I think this goes into that, like, why you're making the work. If you're making the work because you only want to see things through your lens that truly, like, mystify you and, like, floor you and, like, bring you joy and mystery, then, like, yeah, like, you're putting so much more back into those things of giving them worth. And I think that's something interesting too, when you think of like animistic cultures, where they believe that speaking of things is like calling it into being. I think that, like, a lot of times as a photographer, I think about that as, like, you know, photographing something is like breathing life into it. Cause I think that, like, in the same way that poetry a lot of times deals with things that we all see every day and take for granted, I think photography does that a lot too, where it calls forth things that a lot of times we allow to be in the background. And you should call forth the things that, you know, that fill your life with enchantment.
Boom. Mic drop. That's it. I want to end it there. Cause that was a beautiful sort of journey that you just described. Really, man, it covers so many things, and it really distills down one of the elements of why you're using photography as opposed to other mediums. But yeah. Also, I don't want to touch it.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, dude, that was great. Well, why don't we wrap it up?
Cool.
Jesse, thank you so much for taking time out. I really enjoyed talking with you, and so many really wonderful insights that you shared. So thank you for taking the time out and talking with me today.
Yeah, no, thanks for doing this. It was a lot of fun.
So there you go, folks, my conversation with Jesse Lenz. I will share in the show notes links to Jesse's website, also links to the Charcoal Book Club website, the Chico Hot Springs Review website, and for sure, a link to the spot where you can pre-order Jesse's new book, Seraphim, which I believe will be out in February. So you'll definitely want to get your hands on a copy of that, because it sounds amazing. And the images that Jesse has shared with me, really, the work is just outstanding. It was a real pleasure to have Jesse on this episode. And as you can tell, we both really like to talk, and the time did get a little bit away from us, but I wanted this one to maybe be less edited down version of the conversation, just because we covered so many interesting topics, and I just really hit it off with Jesse and enjoyed speaking with him, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. If you have any questions or comments about this episode or any episode, you can go to righteyedominantpodcast.com and you will find all of the episodes and links there, but also scroll down to the bottom of the page. You could send me a note, questions, comments. I love to hear from listeners and always appreciate folks who reach out. I also have a Right Eye Dominant Podcast Instagram page where I share images from each guest. So if you don't follow me there, check it out. And of course, as I always ask, if you could leave a review or a rating on whatever platform you are listening to this on, I would greatly appreciate it. Things have been going really well this season, and I've got a couple of really interesting guests lined up for the next few months. So hope you subscribe and stay along for the ride. So that's going to do it for this episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Taro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The sounds and music from this episode are courtesy of The Comet Project and Yazar.